Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
Mightn't somebody argue that all creative art comes about through something like a mutation in the mind?
Memes. Viruses of the mind?
Mutation in the mind. Mutation in the mind.
We've heard of the selfish gene, but what about the selfish meme?
A meme is not equivalent to an idea. It's not an idea. It's not equivalent to anything else, really. It's that which is imitated, or information which is copied from person to person.
Our guest is Susan Blackmore, author of The Meme Machine.
All other species on this planet are gene machines only. They don't imitate at all well. We alone are gene machines and meme machines as well.
Do popular ideas spread because they're useful or because they're infectious, like a nasty disease?
Any information that is varied and selected will produce design.
Memes, viruses of the mind,
coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that start at Philosopher's Corner down at Stanford. Stanford is where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Today, our topic is memes and the evolution of culture.
You know, Ken, I bet when most of our listeners hear the word meme, they think first of the internet and the viral spread of things like planking, or maybe new expressions like LOL or Gangnam Style or the Harlem Shake.
Now, we may touch on that stuff, John, but that's mostly not what we want to talk about. We want to discuss a serious scientific hypothesis about the evolution of human culture.
And that hypothesis is that memes are to cultural evolution as genes are to biological evolution.
Now, genes, I get, John. They're self-replicating packets of biological information. All that genes want, figuratively speaking, according to the selfish gene hypothesis, is to replicate themselves. There's this competitive process of natural selection that determines which ones will succeed in replicating. The winners in that process, the most fit ones, proliferate. The others, the losers, die off.
It's the same with memes, Ken. Memes are self-replicating, too. They don't encode instructions for building proteins in our bodies like genes do, but rather instructions for building behaviors, beliefs, and emotions in our brains. Like genes, they compete with each other. The memes that win survive, the memes that lose die off.
Yeah, but I always get hung up on the fact that there's a huge difference between the way genes spread and the way, let's call them ideas, spread. Genes make actual physical copies of themselves. Ideas don't do that.
Well, admittedly, the mechanism by which ideas replicate and spread is different from the mechanism by which genes replicate and spread. But I don't see that that's a problem, is it?
Well, it is. It is, John, because, you know, look, we pass on actual physical copies of our genes onto our offspring, actual physical copies. We don't do that with ideas. My ideas, they might influence your ideas, but my ideas are just my ideas. They're forever confined to my head.
Well, you're being too literal. Think of what you just did. You had an idea. You put it into words. I heard the words. Maybe I have the same idea. I at least consider it if I don't believe it. Think about how culture is passed on from generation to generation. You grow up hearing what your parents think about religion. You grow up hearing your parents speak in one language rather than another. It's no accident that we tend to adopt the religion of our parents, at least that's for a start, and speak the language of our parents. That's all non-genetic inheritance. That's the kind of thing that memes can help us understand.
Well, look, I'm not trying to deny that there is a sense in which we get ideas and beliefs and practices from other people. I mean, I grant you, most of what we know, we learn from other people. But that doesn't mean that ideas, or memes, if you want to call them that, literally replicate themselves in our brain.
Well, why doesn't it mean that?
Well, suppose you have an idea for how to do something. Maybe I hear and I learn and I like your idea, maybe. Maybe I even decide to adopt it or I try to improve upon it somehow. None of that is the idea's doing. It's my doing. It's not that ideas actively replicate themselves. I actively adopt some ideas and reject others.
I see, Ken. You think the person or the mind or the self is in the driver's seat. You have this picture of a person kind of rationally weighing the pros and cons of various ideas and then autonomously deciding which ideas to adopt and which ideas to discard. How outmoded.
Outmoded? Isn't that what we do in philosophy all the time, John? Don't we do the same thing in science, too? Look, we consciously put our ideas under scrutiny. We put them to the test. We keep the ones that survive the scrutiny. We reject the ones that don't. That's our doing.
Well, you know, people sometimes do a little genetic engineering, but that's just peripheral. That's around the edges of the basic process. It's the same with ideas. Most of our ideas are not the product of rigorous scientific experimentation or philosophical thinking. If they were, our heads wouldn't be filled with the many awful, pernicious ideas that are there.
Well, you got a point there. I grant you that. That just shows you that philosophy and science can act as antidotes to bad thinking.
No, the point is that for most of us, most of the time, acquiring an idea from another person is more like catching a cold than testing a hypothesis.
Catching a cold? You're comparing ideas to viruses now?
Viruses of the mind, Ken, that spread through a contagion-like process.
And now that would make our brains what, John? A virally infected host?
Exactly right. Self-replicating ideas use our brains to get more of their kind into existence.
Oh, gosh, John, if you've got that analogy, you know that viruses can be quite detrimental to their host.
Well, that's exactly right. So are many memes. Take the suicide bombing meme. My brother blows himself up for some cause or another. I see that and I end up blowing up myself for some cause or another. The meme of suicide bombing for the cause does fine, as it's shown on TV and reported in the paper. My brother and I, we're dead. Memes don't replicate for our benefit. They replicate for their own benefit.
So now first we had the selfish gene hypothesis, and now we have the selfish meme hypothesis.
Exactly. That is to say, the selfish meme has now used me to infect your mind.
Well, I'm not entirely convinced, so I'm still trying to ward off that infection. But, you know, I admit I don't really have a better story right now about why so many silly or harmful ideas like the ones you just mentioned do manage to spread so widely.
Well, for a close-up look at how memes spread, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch. She went out into the wild where some surprising memes have gained a foothold. She files this report.
What makes an idea like planking catch on? Here's a clip from the 2011 season premiere of The Office.
Planking is a very stupid and dangerous trend. Basically, you lie like a plank in weird places. That's it. Sometimes you get run over. Welcome to the internet.
Planking is one of those things where, hey, you either get it or you don't. I don't. But I am so excited to be a part of it.
According to Wikipedia, the term planking was coined by an Australian carpenter about 5 years ago. He created a Facebook page to share planking photos, and the idea just caught on. People all over the world posted photos of themselves lying face down on desks, on live animals, even on a toilet. Plenty of people have been injured while planking, and at least one person even died. Then there are the planking spin-offs, like horsemaning, where you pretend to be headless, or batmaning, where you hang upside down in bizarre locations, and vadering, where you pretend to suspend someone in the air with an invisible chokehold like Darth Vader. All of these are examples of internet memes, a modern-day twist on an old term.
I think what people mean when they say meme is an idea or, you know, a little bit of video or something that catches on and spreads widely.
Rob Boyd is a biological anthropologist at Arizona State University. He confirms that the way the term is used today to describe an internet fad is different from its original definition. The word meme dates back to the late 19th century. Then in 1976, Richard Dawkins reclaimed the idea in the last chapter of his book, The Selfish Gene, comparing the way ideas spread to genes.
Memes do the same as genes, only by different routes. And they potentially survive bodily death just as genes do.
Ideas will evolve just like genes. There'll be natural selection, and we can take a lot of the same machinery and apply it to ideas.
At Arizona State, Boyd studies the evolution of cultural transmission. He says 5 million years ago, humans, like other animals, were non-cultural creatures. That is, we learned largely on our own. Now we learn entirely from other people.
Even the simplest hunting gathering societies rely on knowledge and technology and institutions which are far beyond the capacities of individuals to create.
For example, Inuits in northern North America use skin boats to hunt seals and whales, vitally important for survival. Boyd says the idea of a kayak is beyond what a single person might dream up.
No person invents a kayak. Kayaks arise gradually and slowly over time through the efforts of many individuals and the transmission of their efforts through time.
This uniquely human process of transmitting ideas is fascinating. Why do certain materials or kayak designs catch on and others don't? Why, for example, did the Aleut people make kayaks with a forked bow?
The meme answer is, well, because people found it more attractive. It spread, right? But that really doesn't answer the question.
It's not enough to say an idea caught on. Boyd wants to know why.
Is it because it's functionally more important? So some marine architects have said that it leads to a more efficient bow design. You can actually paddle the kayak a little faster. Other people have said, well, it's a stylistic thing, you know what I mean? And it has to do with distinguishing the Aleuts from their other Inuit neighbors or Yupik neighbors.
Boyd doesn't really buy into the whole meme argument.
One of the problems with the meme point of view is that it doesn't spend enough time worrying about the causal mechanisms that give rise to the selective processes that cause some ideas to spread and other ideas not.
Which brings us back to planking. Why would millions of people take pictures of themselves lying face down and post them to the internet? Well, that might be a question better answered by philosophers.
Kids, don't try planking. It's dangerous.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin. I'm John Perry. With me is my colleague from Stanford University, Ken. Quit planking. Get up in the chair. We've got a show to do.
Well, I'm Ken Taylor, the non-planking Ken Taylor. Today, we're asking about memes. We're joined now by Susan Blackmore. She's a visiting professor at the University of Plymouth. She's author of The Meme Machine, a really cool book. Susan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Susan, in the preface to your book, The Meme Machine, you tell a story about how you were first infected, if I may use that word.
You may indeed.
With an interest in memes. So tell us how that happened.
I don't remember what I wrote in the book, but it all happened when I was very ill. I had chronic fatigue, and I was in bed. I could hardly get up for 6 to 8 months, something like that. And I could only read a little bit. And Dan Dennett's book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, had just come out. And that's full of ideas about memes, extending the ideas that Richard Dawkins put forward in The Selfish Gene. And I was absolutely gripped by this. I'd read The Selfish Gene, but I hadn't noticed the meme idea the first time round. So I read this. It took me something like 3 months to read this book because I was ill. But a lot of the time I was just lying on my back, staring at the ceiling, and the ideas went round and round and round. So many ideas that when about a year later, and then I reread The Selfish Gene and anything I could manage on memes. There wasn't much then. And then when I was better, I had just so full of ideas that I wrote The Meme Machine. And then that's how it came about.
So you really did get infected.
I did indeed get infected. Yes, doubly infected.
So tell us, in your own words, exactly what a meme, the serious scientific concept that you develop in the book, not the concept of internet fame, tell us what this serious concept of a meme comes to.
It comes to information that is copied with variation and selection. I stick, much more than many other people do, I stick to Richard Dawkins' original way of defining it. He took the word meme from the Greek mimema, meaning that which is imitated. So information that is copied from person to person, person to book, book to computer, whatever it is, if as long as it's copied with variation and selection, it counts as a meme. So if you think when you got up this morning and maybe you got a cereal packet with writing on the table, maybe you'd got, you know, bowls and cups and things, all of these things would have been copied from other people. And if you think of how much you're bombarded, particularly in your job as a philosopher, reading ideas all the time, talking to people, arguing, you are bombarded all day with memes. Most of them you forget. And of the ones you remember, only a very few you pass on again. So it's a huge selection pressure. So it's information under selection pressure being passed from person to person.
So that's a helpful starting point. We'll dig into the meme idea in a little bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking about memes and the evolution of culture with our guest Susan Blackmore, author of The Meme Machine.
In our next segment, we'll go on understanding exactly what the meme hypothesis is supposed to explain. We'll ask if memetics can tell us why some ideas spread and proliferate while other ideas die out and disappear. Do memes have a life of their own, independent of our wills? Or are we free to adopt whatever ideas strike us as the best and most plausible?
How ideas spread, when Philosophy Talk continues.
I laughed, I cried, I started a meme. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're talking about memes. How do some ideas manage to spread like wildfire, while other ideas atrophy and die? Does the explanation lie in our memes?
Our guest is Susan Blackmore from the University of Plymouth. She's the author of The Meme Machine.
So, Susan, I want to think about two different sorts of ideas just to get us started, because I want to see how this memetic explanation works in these two different domains. I want to compare scientific ideas on the one hand to religious ideas on the other. Both spread, have spread a lot. And you might think that they spread by rather different mechanisms. One, the scientific method, rigorous testing and all that stuff. And religion, that spreads not in that same way because it's kind of not evidence-based. Now, does meme theory have something deep to say about the difference between the way science spreads on the one hand or religion on the other hand?
I'm not sure you'd call it deep. Maybe you would. But let's go back and think how memes operate. So it's information in our brains that we copy by talking, by telling stories, by singing, by making artifacts, and so on and so on. So the question then becomes, why do some memes spread and others don't? And roughly speaking, you could imagine a continuum, if you like, from ones that spread for really good reasons, like they're true or useful or beautiful or something like that, to ones right at the other end, which we might label viral, which spread even though they're not good or true or useful. They spread because they somehow trick their way into our brains. Now, I would say that religions are close to the viral end of that continuum, and science is close to the other. But they have things in common. I mean, I wouldn't put them at the very, very far end. The difference really is that when you're doing science, if you're a scientist, you have picked up a lot of memes to do with testability, falsifiability, experimental method, design, statistics, all of these kinds of memes, which help you to eliminate the ideas that you would like to be true and actually go for what is true in the universe, what actually happens when you do an experiment. Religion, I would say, operates still with the processes of passing on and copying and so on. But religions, at least the major religions, are full of really nasty tricks to get themselves to stay in your brains. So, for example, if we take Christianity or Islam, both filled with ghastly tricks, they both will claim there's a God. You can't see him, you can't test him, you can't get at him. But you're supposed to have faith, not go out and do tests to find out. So just that very starting point, you know, have faith, not doubt, puts you in a frame of mind that gives them an advantage. Add to that threats and promises. It's really like those old chain letters that go around, you know, if you pass on this, you know, your whole hard drive will get obliterated. Well, you know, that's perhaps even worse than you'll be in hell forever. But they promise untestable glories forever if you're good and you follow the rules and you pass on the memes, and terrible things happening to you in hell if you don't.
Well, Susan, with Dawkins and with Dennett and now with you, there is a certain negativity towards religion that is, let's say, co-varies with liking the meme hypothesis. And one could argue about the differences, but I'm more interested in the meme hypothesis itself. Now, in the whole explanation you just give us, it seems to me that I could just substitute the word meme with the word idea, and it would all be perfectly intelligible. What does the word meme add to our age-old concept of ideas that people have passed through conversation, develop, and some thrive, and some, like most of the ideas I publish, just kind of fall stillborn from the press?
Well, no, he's being self-deprecating falsely.
To a first approximation, that will be fine. But if you think about it this way, not all memes are ideas, and not all ideas are memes. Let me explain that. So first of all, not all memes are ideas. If you do a drawing and then somebody copies it, they might put it in a photocopier, they might email it, they might fax it or whatever. It's not really an idea, is it? It's a drawing, but it can be copied. And if people like it, they'll copy more. And if they don't, they'll screw it up and throw it in the waste paper basket. On the other hand, not all ideas are memes. You could have an idea. You dream up some idea in your own mind and then forget it. It never gets passed on to anybody else. It never becomes a meme. So although you might like to say that, loosely speaking, memes are ideas, the point about thinking memetically is really this. You stop thinking about us human beings as the center of agency who are controlling ideas of our own free will, selecting this and that. In a sense, we're doing all the selecting, but we are the meme machines. We're the selection machines in this much, much wider process in which a whole mass of self-replicating information is out there in culture. Each of us little ones are picking it up, copying it, not copying it.
Susan, I get that point from the mimetic approach. You talk about the people in biology sometimes, especially people who believe in the selfish gene hypothesis, talk about the gene's eye view, and you're kind of an advocate of what you might call the meme's eye view.
Right. Indeed, yeah.
I get that. But I really have some trouble with that because I don't know that ideas have any intrinsic sort of replicating power. Genes, they got this whole machinery of replication, these self-replicating molecules. They've got this whole machinery. What memes have is us and our interest in all kinds of things. I mean, I have an interest in having ideas that are true rather than ideas that are false. I have an interest. The ideas don't have any interest in being true or false. I have an interest in ideas that subserve social cohesion with my fellow. That, you know, religion is this is this group thing, right? I have an interest in having ideas that bind me together with my fellow beings that regulate our behavior toward one another. The ideas don't have any interest in that. I mean, it's so I don't get this shift from memes I view.
Okay, let me try and help you make that shift.
Okay.
The reason you're finding it so hard is because you're hanging on really hard to the idea of an I in here who is free to choose the ideas and so on. You really want there to be this inner self who's in there and doing it. Now, scientifically, when we look at a brain, we do not find an inner self. We don't even find a middle of the brain where it might be to do that job. Selves are, I would say, from the neuroscience and all my studies of consciousness and so on, they are ephemeral constructs being made by brains all the time. And how are they made by brains? Because those brains are infected by loads and loads of memes. Also, you started by saying you don't see what the machinery is. Well, the equivalent machinery is us, yes, but not me, not a little mythical me in there. It's this whole machine of a body and a brain and all these neurons which are processing memes all the time and throwing them out and so on and giving rise to this idea of a self.
Well,
unless
Susan,
can drop the idea of a sort of spiritual, sort of, I don't know, a soul, or I don't know, some kind of inner self who's in control, unless you can drop that, you can't make the flip to seeing that we are a meme machine.
Well, Susan, I must admit, I think your theory of what we mean by self is completely wrong. I mean, I think of myself as a physical, integrated human body. When I use the word I, that's what I refer to. I have all kinds of properties, including interests. I don't need to think of myself as some kind of mythical inner being to suppose that I have interests and properties and entertain hypotheses. But I mean, I accept a lot about the idea of memes, but with when we study viruses, a large part of that is studying the different kinds of environments in which different viruses can replicate and others can't. Now, what you said, making fun of the concept of self, is really just, I think, wrong, because we have a whole theory of understanding persons, by which I just mean flesh and blood persons, that includes concepts like ideas, thoughts, hypotheses, testing, wants, desires. I don't see how you're going to explain how memes work if you jettison all that and say it's just superstition and philosopher's nonsense.
I'm not jettisoning at all the idea. You were saying there that you equate yourself with the whole body. I'd be surprised if you do. I mean, I'm sure you will say things like, these are my hands, or this is my brain, or whatever. You probably, like most people, have a sense of a self who is inhabiting the body.
I do not have any concept of a self as inhabiting the body.
You've got rid of that. Okay.
No, I think you're confusing selves with self-concepts. Yes, we construct self-concepts and little narratives in our mind, and they're very ephemeral. And probably a huge number of people get by without doing much of that at all, and philosophers are probably entranced by that. But I think if you look at the way people use the word I and say, I hurt, I'm in pain, I'm going to do this, there's just no evidence at all that the word I or the concept of self is infected with the superstition you're talking about.
Why don't we let some callers in here, because we've got some interesting callers. Kelly from Santa Cruz is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talks, Kelly.
Morning. It's first time. It's a great show. It sounds interesting. The meme machine sounds like it has a spiritual side, and that was what I wanted to address. In Buddhism, there's this idea called the Alaya Plane of Habits, meaning there's this storage house where all the habits, all the ideas, all the building blocks of your normal day are accessed like a library and put back as needed during the day. And that we don't actually generate or contain any of these. We are the selectors, but we pull in from this bank, this library, if you will. The problem is, in your whole conversation, is the background is what is consciousness. And consciousness is either local or it's non-local, meaning you can go into quantum physics and say it's like entanglement, or you can say everything's just like on your own body. So there's a consciousness defined.
Yeah, we're going to let Susan. She has lots of thoughts about these things. Susan, thanks for the call, Kelly. Susan, what do you think about what Kelly had to say there?
Well, as you said, there were a lot of things there. Let me start where he started, with there being something spiritual in this. Yes, in a sense, and very much close to some Buddhist ideas. The trouble with Buddhism, like so many religions, it's spread into so many different directions that you can't say that all ideas are common to it. So I'm not so sure about this storehouse thing, which appears in some versions of Buddhism, but not others. But the central idea that the self is temporary, doesn't persist, comes and goes, and the ideas are making it up all the time, is compatible between Buddhism and memetics. And he said there's a spiritual dimension to this. Yes, because you find in many spiritual practices the idea of giving up self, of giving up free will, of surrender, and so on. And those things, I think, come quite well out of memetics. I mean, we're jumping away from the science of memetics here into some of the things that I'm particularly interested in. But yes, that it takes us there. It takes us to no free will, acceptance of how things are, and letting the ideas do their thing.
But Susan, it seems to me that's a terrible danger. I mean, there is a kind of a religion or ideology here, very anti-individualistic, because you want to get rid of the concept of the individual self's role in this, and we're just meme machines. What's important is the meme, and this is already kind of latent in science, where there's so much interest in truth. But I find that just on a par with other religions that say, oh, you know, get rid of the self for the greater good, you know, patriotism, or get rid of the self to spread the religion.
I wouldn't say it's getting rid of the stuff. I would say it's being truthful about what it is. Instead of thinking, as in most religions do, or the major faiths do, that the self is some kind of spirit or soul that that is inhabiting the body and will survive after death.
Do you find that in the Old Testament or the New Testament?
Well, you find the idea of heaven and hell.
Yeah, but you don't find the idea of an inner self anywhere in the Old Testament or in the New Testament.
Well, you wouldn't call it.
You don't find it in Confucianism. You don't find it very much in Buddhism.
No, not in Confucianism, but you certainly find it. No, and in Buddhism, the one of the major teachings in Buddhism is anatta, or the temporary, changing nature of self.
I mean, this self isn't really from religion. It's from religious philosophy of the medieval times. Really, that's where this whole idea of the Cartesian self comes in, not from the religion.
But what I was trying to say was not to throw out the self, to be more realistic. And I want to, let me just say something about why I think this is so important. Because if you look at the history of science, it's very often been one of changing the role of human beings in the world. So we used to be seen to be the center of the universe and the sun going around the earth and us being important. Many, many people alive and certainly in many religions think that God made this planet for us. We get demoted by science. Mimetics is another strand of this kind of demotion, if you like, and I think it's very important. Because so long as we think we are the really powerful ones in charge of our technology, we made all this technology, so we're in control, we're going to tell what happens to it, see it from a meme's eye view and realize that actually we're not. It goes like any evolutionary process, it goes faster and faster, and we are not the controllers of this. We're just an inner part of it.
Susan and John both, I take both of your points. I think there is a deep metaphysical issue here. There really is a deep metaphysical issue about what the self is and all that. And I do think some scientists, some neuroscientists, brain scientists especially think they have exploded the old idea of the self. But I don't really agree with that, but that's a whole topic. But I don't really think the analogy with genes is a good one. I don't think that ideas taken just on their own have any replicative drive. People. Now, what exactly people are, I don't know, right? And whether they're persons in this Cartesian or what people have, they're hungry, and I think this is an evolved disposition. They're hungry for solidarity with other people. They're hungry to learn from other people. And I agree, it's a cool evolutionary trick among human beings to exploit the minds of others. We have this capacity for mind reading and all this sort of stuff. We have this capacity for language. There are lots of theories about that that I don't think need to see memes as replicators and the brain as just the vehicle for the replicators. I don't see that that buys you anything.
It's not so much of a vehicle. If you want to draw this analogy, and I want to be clear that mimetics doesn't rest on this analogy.
Okay,
mimetics rests on universal Darwinism, the idea that whenever you have any information that is copied with variation and selection, you'll get an evolutionary process. So genes are one example and memes are another. Now, you quite rightly said in your introduction, you called genes self-replicating packets of information. Well, they are, but they're only self-replicating when they are in the presence of all the machinery, all the RNA and all the replication machinery and the cell and all the resources they need to do that job of getting replicated. And the same is true of memes. It's an analogy only that we've drawn on this basis, but the analogy is memes are self-replicating information, which can be encoded in black and white on paper, different growth of dendrites in brains, all sorts of different ways, behaviors in bodies, and they use humans as the machinery. So they are self-replicating when in the presence of that machinery. So the analogy is pretty good as long as you accept that the way of the kinds of machinery and the kinds of copying and varying selecting are very different in the two cases.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about memes with Susan Blackmore, author of The Meme Machine.
Memes are supposed to have lives of their own. They, not we, are in the driver's seat when it comes to the evolution of culture. So are our concepts of reason, consciousness, and the self really just illusions in a world ruled by selfish memes?
Memes, reason, and the self, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Are we all copycatting one another's memes? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Susan Blackmore from the University of Plymouth. And we're looking at the idea that memes replicate in a way analogous to the way genes do. And we've got a caller in the line, Lydia in El Cerrito. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lydia.
Oh, hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm very interested in this topic, and I have a question involving the trend towards veganism in terms of how we nourish ourselves and also how, we nourish each other and the evolution of the planet. It's a trend that I see will have not only a philosophical but also, genetic and biological consequences and evolutionary consequences. So I'm very interested in your take on what this is, and is this truly a meme, or what's going on here?
Thanks for the question, Lydia. So Lydia's in a way asking us can we give a mimetic explanation, and how would a mimetic explanation of something like the rise and spread of veganism work? And what new insight could we gain from taking a mimetic approach?
If you're interested in the reasons that it spreads, then lots of other theories of cultural evolution would help you, and theories of psychology and why people want to do it and so on. But the mimetic approach gives one a different view. Take a kind of planetary-wide view. Think of the trouble this planet is in because of all these humans. Just imagine for a moment this planet with 8 billion people on it. So there are different organisms spreading, they're dying out, forests going, all of these things, and people eating more and more meat and more fish and overfishing the resources and so on. And then you've got different memes, such as veganism or ordinary vegetarianism or all these different kinds of diets. These are spreading. You could imagine drawing a map of the planet on which these different memes are spreading. And the health of the planet will depend on how many people are eating meat, using up all those resources in the way they are, and how much veganism spreads will have a big impact. So I think one of the powerful aspects of mimetics is being able to take this wider view and look at the whole integrated system rather than just a particular idea of why does veganism spread at this moment in this place.
Well, I think that's a very good answer, a very good analysis. I want to be clear, Ken and I may not be skeptical about the same things. I think the idea of information that is copied with variation and spreads through populations is a really useful concept. That's what you define meme as. But I think this is an example of how this religion, anti-religion component might be pried off. Because isn't what the world really needs is not something with logically or scientific justification, but some kind of meme that spreads to the world the way a Muslimism spread to the Near East, that says consumption isn't everything, production isn't everything, the world is sacred. We need a really good meme more than we need science at this point, because the science is there. We know we're killing the thing.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I'm doing my best with explaining mimetics because I really think the view it gives us could be valuable. But there's no doubt we have not got a really strong, thriving science of mimetics yet. If we did, we should be able to design, from everything we know, from all the memes we've got, we should be able to design those kinds of memes. We should be able to ensure that people understand about climate change and so on. We should be able to put disinfectant memes out there to stop the worst tricks that religions use. They're always the example that comes up, but we should be able to design memes to do particular jobs. It's jolly difficult, and as you know, everyone who wants to make a viral meme and they don't succeed, and then when ones go viral, you can look back and say, well, that's why.
Well, if you
mimetics needs to improve a lot.
If you just substitute the word corporation for the word religion in what you just said, we're exactly on the same page.
Look, I don't.
I agree.
I don't disagree with this, with sort of the tenor of what you just said, but I do think the following, that, and I think you kind of conceded it just before the break. I could take it as a kind of concession. If you really want to understand how ideas spread, you have to understand the environment in which they get replicated. And what's the environment in which they get replicated? Human minds with their cognitive architecture, their function, their all that sort of stuff. The spread of ideas is still the work of the mind somehow. And the mind is a really fascinating, multifaceted thing, and we don't understand it well enough. We think we understand the nature of human reason. I don't think we do. We think we understand the nature of human emotions. I don't think we do. So I agree that once we have a really good theory of the mind, which is the environment in which ideas thrive, we'll get a deeper understanding of all this stuff. But I'm going to let a caller in here, Keith from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I think that the idea of memes is very interesting and also plausible. And my question is, how would it be tested for truth or falseness?
Good question, Keith. Does the meme theory make some surprising predictions, Susan, you know, that are borne out by...
Well, this is the ultimate question, because if it's a scientific theory, it's got to do that. And if it's just some kind of vague, waffly idea, then no. I could give you a few examples.
Okay.
One of the ones that excited me most, in The Meme Machine, which has been, you know, quite a long time ago I wrote it,
It's really fun to read even today. It's a great book.
It really is. Thank you. Thanks. In there, I was speculating about the origins of language, and you know, people have done that for hundreds of years, and there's all kinds of theories out there. But the way I was developing the memes idea led me to think that language would emerge. If you had two robots, I called them copy bots, if you had two simple robots that would copy, look at something and then copy the noise the other one made, and they'd keep making lots of noises, and there would be too many noises for them to copy everything. If you had lots of copy bots, a whole room full of them, there'd be so much noise that they wouldn't be able to copy everything, so you get selection pressure, then language, in other words, sounds relating to things, ought to just emerge spontaneously. Well, to my amazement, a few years later, I was at a conference, and there was somebody there who's done research, Luke Steels, who's done research using very, very simple robots called talking heads, and they were simply looking at different shapes and so on, and making a noise. One made a noise, the other copied it, and out of that emerged sounds with reference. Now, there's all sorts of research going on the evolution of language along that lines, but I think that was a pretty dramatic prediction, and it came out. And other predictions to do with brain size. I mean, I would say that my whole argument that we the humans have such big brains because the memes forced us to, because once you start copying the information and there's more and more memes and you've got to be a better meme selector and better and better and better and so on, that drove our big brain. You would expect in any species that have imitation, the brain size would correlate with imitation. Now, there are very, very few other species who have imitation, but certainly in hummingbirds that seems to be the case, and there is a little bit of evidence that is true.
So, now, I want to try something out on you. Suppose I could convince you. So one of the things that is clear to me from this conversation, from reading your book, is that, like, the old Cartesian idea of a self as this little agency within us, you don't like it. Lots of people don't like it. Dennett doesn't like it. No, I don't think I know a single neuroscientist that like it. And if that's what a self had to be, I wouldn't like it either. But I've got a pretty modest view of the self, but I still think on this modest view of the self is in charge. I wonder if I could talk you out of meme theory, if I could talk you into a more modest view of
a
self like this. What is it to be a self? It's just to be a self-representing creature. Self-representing creatures are just creatures that can have I thoughts, that can say, I decided to do that. That's just a kind of form of representation. That's different from representing Ken Taylor. John can represent Ken Taylor, but when he represents Ken Taylor, he's not representing himself. I'm a self-representer. You're a self-representer. Some of our self-representations are full of hooey because we have self-concepts of all kinds of fictional kinds. You know, we do a lot of self-justifying. But this capacity for self-representation and being one self-representing creature among another is a huge evolutionary leap forward, and it gives rise to lots of cool things that weren't there before. And if I had a theory of the self like that, could I still have the self and not be committed to the memes I view, but have a self-I view, as it were?
I can take the self-I view, and I can take the memes-I view, and I can take the genes-I view. Yes, I absolutely agree with you. We are self-modeling organisms, if you like, self-representing organisms. But there's a lot of problems with the way we represent ourselves. So, for example, we represent ourselves, most people do, not everybody, as something in some unitary, coherent, persisting entity that was the same one that woke up this morning, was the same one that decided to do this, that agreed to be on this program, wrote this book, and so on. So we assume continuity when actually it's probably not there. The representations come and go and change all the time and appear and disappear. We represent ourselves as having power. So when we say, I decided to drive this particular route to get to the studio today rather than the other route, we're attributing that decision to this kind of coherent self, when actually it's probably to do with a signpost I saw there, or the temperature, or the cloud in the sky, or some other thing, or what I was listening to on the radio at the time. a lot of the time, I would say practically all the time, we're giving post hoc rationalizations as to what the body did. This whole body, full of amazing capacities and different systems in the brain doing different jobs, we simplify it all in that representation. And that's one of the problems that we have.
See, now, my analysis would be that you've really bought in, bit in, drank the Kool-Aid of a certain philosophical conception of the self, and now you're discovering that it's bogus. But instead of saying, oh, I had the wrong understanding of the self, you're saying, oh, the self doesn't exist. I think most people, most of the time, don't use that philosophical concept except when they're in the philosophy classroom or...
I mean,
we have this huge vocabulary that's proven very helpful and helps us every day in dealing with other people. He decided this. Why did he decide that? Well, he saw a signpost and he's very impressionable. The concept of self, belief, imagination, these are aids to whatever memetics has to offer, not opponents.
Yes, but I didn't say the self doesn't exist. I said it isn't what we think it is. It doesn't have these qualities of being...
You think it ought to be.
Look at the surveys done. I mean, there are, I'm glad to say, a lot more research going on in psychology now about what people really think. Lots and lots of surveys of people's idea of free will, which really is contra-causal, magical kind of free will.
No, I don't look at that.
Large proportions of people.
I don't look at that. I don't look at that. I think psychologists should spend too much time on it. I look at people the way people actually... use and describe decisions when they're not in psychological surveys and they're not in the philosophical classroom.
So they say, I made a decision, and we can show by lots of psychological experiments that you can manipulate, you can cause somebody to say, I decided to do that. If you're very clever and you manipulate them with subconscious cues, you know, subliminal cues and all sorts of other things, you can get them to do something that you want them to do and say that they freely decided it. So, you know, that shows what?
Well, John, so I think there are lots...
That shows common sense, right? That's what everybody has always believed about other people.
But we're getting
away
from means.
We've got whole books like Dale Carnegie that tell you how to do that.
Yeah. But we're getting away from means. I think where self and consciousness connect up with memetics is this, that what we would expect of memes is that a human being with an amazing brain evolved over all these this long time to be capable of copying ideas is also copying language, which enables us to have a certain kind of representation of self. It gives us ideas about what we want and don't want. The self, who I think I am, you know, you're John, you're Ken, I'm Sue, those self-concepts are very much dependent on the memes that we've grown up with all our lives. So I would call the self a great big memeplex, a co-adapted system of memes sustained by a physical brain in the body. And if you see the self that way, I think it's much easier to understand why we make all these odd decisions and then justify them afterwards by saying, well, I wanted to do it because, when we can show psychologically that actually there were other causes for those
actions. So, Susan, there's a lot more we could dig into, but unfortunately, we're going to have to bring this conversation to a close. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest has been Susan Blackmore. She's a visiting professor at the University of Plymouth, author of The Meme Machine. This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow our tweets on Twitter and find out more by visiting our very, very active Facebook page.
Now, to spread ideas even faster than a meme, here's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, one of the strangest things about our informational age to me is how ideas are given a quick spin through the digital dryer and come out magically as a brand new thought, never thunk before. The meme is a prime example. First coined by Richard Dawkins in his 1976 book, The Selfish Gene, a meme was conceived as a unit of cultural propagation, like DNA, only virtual, as an idea, behavior, or style that spreads from person to person. According to Wikipedia, where memes go to die, Dawkins' examples included melodies, catchphrases, fashion, and the technology of building arches. I don't know how building arches got in there, but who am I to argue with the intuitive passage of cultural knowledge? Well, memes really took off with the rise of the internet, which contains insufferably memorable photos, animation songs, little stupid movies. When I first read about memes, I considered them just a fad, on steroids. But then I realized that describing something as being on steroids was itself a meme, as well as saying something's like something on acid. Also, saying epic fail, don't tase me bro, more cowbell, and all your bases belong to us. Curiously, both Gwyneth Paltrow and pathological dislike of Gwyneth Paltrow could both be considered memes. Stupid lists are themselves an internet meme, and among those are listicles, list, article, get it? Like the best memes of the last 15 years from About.com and Wikipedia's sampling of internet phenomena. You got your lolcats, your rage comics, your Rickroll, your no-no-no-cat, the screaming ghost, the OK Go music videos, the Numa Numa dance, the Muppets Bohemian Rhapsody, pretty much anything on YouTube. If it has cats and dogs making weird noises. Remember Mahir the Turk? Unlikely superpower claims for Chuck Norris, the dancing baby in Hamster Dance, the Harlem Shake, and Lonely Girl 15? There's Ask a Ninja, what happens when Diet Coke meets Mentos, the rise of Grumpy Cat to superstardom, the Bill Gates email beta test on the upside, and the good times virus on the down, though they both kind of even themselves out by ultimately not existing. Pants on the ground, rent is too damn high, the Nigerian scam, there's the Three Wolf Moon Saga, the epic tale of the one red paperclip. A meme becomes a trope, then a theme, then a cliche, some fade away, some linger. Unlike fads, the Davy Crockett coonskin caps or hula hoops or Rubik's Cubes or whatever, memes are not looked upon with fondness. We smile when we remember Bert and Ernie or Clint Eastwood or Kevin Bacon, but with 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, the Bert is evil trope, and the relatively new phenomenon of talking to an empty chair known as Eastwooding, we just note it on the go, ignore the link, close the window, move on. So that happened. And that's a meme, too. Apparently the word meme is itself a meme. Are we nothing but a sad collection of memes? I don't know. I gotta go. But is that a meme? Sadly, no. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2013.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, iTran, Carola Kreitmar, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.